Been looking forward to this interview for a while. The talk of Liverpool, 33 years of conversations with my heroes and some villains, 30 years of exclusive interviews. The talk of Liverpool is a unique record of life in one of the world's most talked about cities across four headline-making decades. Paddy Sheenan covered the biggest subjects and talked to people who dominated Merseyside life between the 1980s and the present day. You're here to talk about the good, the bad, and the occasionally ugly is the man himself, Paddy Sheenan. Paddy, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Nice to speak to you. How are you doing?
Not too bad, thank you. If you're going to be writing, if you're going to be interviewing people, then Liverpool is perhaps one of the best places to be based. Because let's face it, there's nowhere quite like Liverpool, is there?
There isn't. The people, it's a bit of a cliche, people's talking about the friendly people, but they are, and they're very open. That's what I found. My parents were from Liverpool, and they moved away for work reasons before I was born. So I spent the first 3 years of my career in my hometown of Preston, which is about an hour's drive away. Fine newspaper, fine people. But I did notice that in that 40 miles, there is a difference. There's a difference between Liverpool and Manchester, which is just down the road as well. The people are very, very open, very friendly, very, you know, they stick up for themselves. They got opinions, and they're not afraid, which is great for a journalist. They're not afraid to share those opinions. Some people, you know, in various parts of the UK, I would suggest, are a little bit shy, a little bit coy of allowing people into their lives and to tell people what they actually believe and what their views are. But you don't get that in Liverpool at all.
Yeah, so who were you writing for then? What was your... Let's give you the official title for those 33 years.
Well, I had a few titles, but...
The ones that we can repeat, Paddy.
I had all sorts of names. I was very lucky in that I wasn't, I don't think, a natural reporter, which is what most journalists going into the industry start off as. I was always, I think, from day one, wanting to get into what is known as feature writing, which is the ability to, rather than just tell straightforward news stories, which don't really give you the chance to, you know, go into a great deal of detail and show maybe a bit of your own personality. I got into features 5 years into my Echo career. So that is basically interviewing, going out and interviewing people on the stories of the day, having a lot more space to tell a story, maybe 1,000 words rather than 200 words, writing columns. I was very lucky to write a TV column every week for most of my time on the Echo. A pub column, which was fantastic fun, as much fun as you can imagine writing a pub column in Liverpool, some of the best pubs in the world, and an opinion column, which was the greatest privilege of all. Someone saying to you, you've got 500 words every Wednesday to just write what you want about whoever it may be in the news that week. That is a fantastic honour and privilege. And it's only now, I think, having left the Echo a couple of years ago, that I'm having gone through all my stuff in the loft, because, you know, this is what one of the rules in life is: when you leave a job after many, many years and you've got nothing to do, you go up into the loft to sort it out. And that's how the book came about, that I'm a great hoarder, and I found all these articles, some of which I wasn't too keen on keeping, but a lot of them I thought, this was actually quite a good job I had, you know, and I want to share this and have it sort of down for posterity. So feature writing, very, very lucky. Go out and meet people. You go into their homes, sometimes at the worst possible parts of their lives. But then on the other side of the coin, lots of quirky, unusual, lighthearted features, interviewing comedians and TV stars and what have you. So it's a real mix of the serious, the important, and the frankly, totally unimportant.
And another thing about the fact is that you're writing for one of the most, and I hate using this word, but it's true in this case, iconic newspaper. If you think of London, you think of The Standard, you think of Manchester, the Manchester Evening News, you think of Liverpool, it's The Echo. Simple as that.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, I remember before joining, you know, just you'd tune into Brookside or whatever it is, and people were talking about The Echo. You know, it wasn't the Liverpool Echo, it's just The Echo. Everything's shortened in Liverpool. Every name is shortened. And The Echo did have that sort of cachet about it, still does. And, yeah, again, no disrespect to my hometown paper, but The Echo, such a big beast in newspapers, and I was so keen to join it, and I just punched the air with joy when I got the job. You know, it's a campaigning newspaper. It was a paper that wasn't, again, like reflecting the city it was reporting on, wasn't scared to go out on a limb sometimes and say what it felt about certain issues. And you're right, it was an iconic, it is an iconic brand.
And also, 33 years on the Echo, it is the way that Liverpool or Merseyside has changed in those 33 years. Because if you wind back then to the late 80s, early 90s, I mean, this is Albert Dock is only just getting itself together. You've got the Merseyside Development Corporation kicking into gear, you know, revitalizing places like New Brighton, etc. Because previous to that, I mean, Liverpool in the 70s and 80s, with the greatest respect to the fine city, you know, it needed a change. It needed to be, it was starting to fade, shall we say, Paddy? Kindly?
Yeah. And you mentioned, I'm glad you mentioned the Albert Dock. That's a great example. It's funny, when you're there, when you sort of, you're living it, you're absorbing it, you don't really see, people often look back and go, oh, what you just said, basically, Giles, you know, dreadful time. And looking back, you think, my God, it was very different. The Albert Dock, I remember watching that as an 18-year-old on Boys from the Black Stuff. And Alan Bleasdale, I'm glad to say, one of my heroes, is in the book. And one of my favourite scenes, one of the most powerful scenes in that series, was in the last episode, George's Last Ride, where George Malone is being wheeled around what is then a derelict Albert Dock. It's covered in mud. And at the time, I don't know, maybe because I was so young, I just accepted that is the Albert Dock. Obviously, it had a great history. And I remember his character, and this was ad-libbed by the late, great Peter Kerrigan, the actor. Alan Leesdale was very kind and had no ego about this, said that this great line, and I told him it was my favourite line in this whole 5 hours of Boys from the Black Stuff. George Malone's being wheeled around this derelict Albert Dock, and he said to Michelangelo's character, Chrissy, I can't believe there's no hope. And when you think back to that scene and what happened later with the Albert Dock reopening, and it's now just this gorgeous, always been a gorgeous set of buildings, but revitalized there. It's just fantastic what's happened. And 2008, of course, we were laughed at in 2003 when the announcement was made that Liverpool was going to be capital of culture. A lot of people in London and other parts of the country couldn't quite believe that this was happening. They thought, you know, Liverpool was a basket case and didn't deserve this title. But they didn't see the changes that were taking place. And Liverpool, so many people I've interviewed who've left the city and come back, and they've said they've walked around it and didn't actually recognise the city from the city they knew because of so many changes, so many new shops, etc., and so many just, you know, the whole infrastructure of the city centre has changed.
And if you think about Bleasdale, it must be, you know, wonderful to meet him, you know, intelligent guy. But if you think about Boys from the Black Stuff and when it was written, and it showed, you know, the character of the people. It gave us, in Yossi Hughes, you know, one of the, I mean, I remember kids walking around going, "Giz a job, I can do that, giz a job." Because there was very little hope. Liverpool was a basket case in the nicest possible way. And yet it has changed, it's transformed. And that's been one of the remarkable things. And it's perhaps because of the strength and the character of the people that have made that. And that's one of the threads that runs through anything that you write about Liverpool is the strength of the people and the fact that there is no off switch with Liverpool leaders.
Yeah. It's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you think about it, and let's do, because you know, life is made of, you know, light and dark and many shades in between. So let's do the dark stuff first, because it's impossible to write a story about Liverpool without recognizing some of the tragedies that have come through. And the fact that Liverpool is real life. It's not, it may be, you know, one of the biggest tourist attractions in the tourist cities and destinations in the world, what with, you know, Beatles experience, etc., the galleries, etc. But also there have been problems. There's been crime, and there've been some horrendous images that have basically seared onto the national consciousness. We think of the Bulger image of almost like a sick version of the Clark Shoe advert with the little boy being led away. If you remember that from there,
yeah. Well, that's obviously the book does have. It's got an interview with Denise Fergus, James's mum, and she talks about that image, because obviously that was the first the very first sort of, that was a starting point of the story for everybody when they saw that. It was, I remember it was made the late editions of the Saturday of that weekend after, obviously, the poor James went missing, was reported missing on the Friday. And Denise told me that she saw that image and her first reaction, her first emotion was relief. Because she thought, he's with two little lads, you know, two little lads. And James loved other kids. And she just assumed that he must be safe in some way. Of course, the full horror emerged. So, you know, we've got that. The book starts with, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know the story of tragic murder of Helen McCourt, whose body has never been found to this day. And Ian Sims, the murderer, died at the weekend. And I was a rookie. This was before I was a feature writer in 1988. The reports, again, it was a missing person. See, there was fears about what might have happened, but I was sent out to help out the local St. Helens reporter to go and get some background, to get some colour. And I thought, I'll go and the pub, local pub, you know, it was a good place to start. Hadn't opened that day. And I thought, I'll go and speak to the pub landlord. And I met this bloke just parking his car. Asked him, you know, explained who I was. And I said, is this your pub? He said, yes, it's, you know, I'm the landlord. I said, oh, did you know Helen McCourt? Do you know Helen McCourt, who'd gone missing? And he said, yes. I said, oh, are you okay? Just have a few words with the echo, you know. And so, yeah, come inside. And we walked around the corner to the front of the pub, and there were some plainclothes detectives waiting to speak to Ian Sims. And obviously, at the moment, at that time, they were asking all sorts of people, you know, for help with their inquiries. And there was nothing to suggest anything untoward about Ian Sims. And I remember in my naivety, as they led him into the pub, shouting after the officers, can I have a chat with him first, please, for the echo? And of course, they told me in no uncertain terms that I couldn't. And he was charged with Helen's murder a short time later. The book also includes Madeleine McCann. I was so lucky to be welcomed into the home of the grandparents of Madeleine, the late Brian Healy, who died a couple of years ago, and spoke to Susan Healy recently. Susan Healy, and they were so, again, we'd go back to people at the most traumatic times of their lives, welcoming in a complete stranger into their living room on several occasions, because they want to keep this story alive. They want awareness about Madeleine, the fact she was missing. They wanted her to be found. You know, the racist murder of Anthony Walker. There's a lovely conversation in the book between G. Walker, Anthony's mum, and Doreen Lawrence, who came up to support her from London. Obviously, Doreen's son, Stephen, was also victim of a racist murder. And the longest chapter in the book, and most important to me, I think, because I wrote about this subject far more than anything else, naturally, given my time at the Echo, 33 years, is Hillsborough. So, yeah, all these terrible, terrible events have got to be covered. And it, as you said before, it's part of the light, the shade.
Let's just touch on this quickly, because I was watching the Champions League final in Paris this year, and I was listening to it on the radio, because, you know, radio is a more intimate media, and listening to the voices that were coming in and the reports, and you just got this feeling, didn't you? And know that there were Liverpool fans, there were crushes, there was disorganisation and chaos, and you could hear that in the background, there was that spectre coming up again. And no event has seared itself across a town, a city's consciousness like Hillsborough. Not just the terrible events. And I remember being a teenager watching it in Spain live. And then the aftermath. And that, if anything, brought Liverpool together as an entity, as a we stand against the rest of the effing world, more so than any other an event. And it just, because it's the 96 is still remembered. And I spoke to Liverpool fans the week after when they returned from Paris, and we talked about it, and they were saying that, yeah, you know, this is a defining event in a city that is not afraid to look at its dark side as well as its lighter moments.
That's right. Hillsborough, I mean, you touched on Paris there, and I think what's important, the good, the positive thing about that Paris, what dreadful events in Paris, is social media. I was at the other semi-final that day in 89 in Birmingham, watching Everton, my team, and we had no idea until 5 o'clock, and it was just amazing. Today's young generation would, you know, Hillsborough would have been known about before it happened, if you see what I mean, before the crushers led to the police doing or not doing what they should have done, and the tragedy unfolding. We weren't told anything about that other game. We're just told, we were told that the game had been delayed. So I was saying to my mates, great, we can listen to the Liverpool game on the way home. I saw a billboard outside a newsagent on the way to the car at 10 to 5, 5 to 5, and it said 72 dead at the time, I think it was, in stadium horror. And I said to my mates, oh, this must be some shocking, poor incident in a third world country where they haven't got decent stadia, they haven't got a decent police force. And to our horror, we got on and found it was happening up the road in the UK. But you're right, the people of the city came together like I've never seen. And just on the families and the campaigners, I've got to say, people not connected with journalism often say to me in the pub or whatever, oh, you know, you've interviewed so many people. Who are the best people you've ever interviewed? And I think they probably expect me to say some celebrity or other. And I've had great fun, great times interviewing celebrities. But the best people by far I've interviewed are the Hillsborough families and the Hillsborough campaigners, because what they've been through is just unimaginable to me. It could have been Everton fans that day, so maybe I can imagine it. But not just to go through it, but then to have that drive to campaign in public and to have the victories, which the book focuses on the positive, the victories, the Hillsborough Independent Panel report of 2012 and the fantastic second inquest verdicts of unlawful killing in 2016. So I wanted to demonstrate that despite various people getting away with various things, this was there were massive victories for the Hillsborough families in that long campaign.
Let's move to the light. Let's get away from the show. Come on. I mean, tell me people interview. Alexis Sale and Ken Dodd. Not at the same time, I would imagine. That would have been interesting. No. But Alexis Sale, of course. Alexis Sale's got a place down in Spain. He's written a book about life, a book based
in
a
Barcelona Plates, his book. He's an interesting character, Alexi. He's very. I put him and Ken Dodd together at the start of the comedy, chapter, because I think they were two of the comedians I interviewed most, and I couldn't think of two comedians more opposite. I mean, Ken Dodd's always spoke about he called it the rainbow of comedy, and he talked about I can't remember the exact quote. It's a very long quote about the light colours and what they represent. I think he said the white is the innocent laughter of children in the playground you hear, who are just laughing because they're glad to be alive. And he got to the other end of the rainbow and he talked about the purple being the satire, the anger. And basically, he was describing Alexis Sale's comedy. And I got the impression that Doddy was not a great fan of Have I Got News For You or various English satirical programs, which might all be...
Kendall on the Young Ones, I can see it now.
Well, exactly. And, you know... He was from Doddy was from the music hall tradition, and he was just a fantastic joke teller and just polar opposite to Alexis Sale. But Alexis Sale, I love as well, and I thought it would be interesting to put them both together at the start of that chapter. But other people in that chapter, Johnny Vegas, who talked quite sort of poignantly, I think. Obviously, his real name is Michael Pennington, but very few people, even around Liverpool, obviously in St. Helens, where he's from, but even in Liverpool, just Johnny Vegas, he's Johnny Vegas. And Johnny spoke quite openly about how the whole point was, took it as a great compliment when people got him mixed up, that he was playing this character, this drunken, Guinness-swilling Johnny Vegas. But then he said he did get lost in that character a bit, which I thought was quite, honest of him to say that his real persona, his real life, Michael Pennington, behaved maybe quite badly at certain times, as Johnny Vegas might do. So he was fascinating. I've got to tell you, Ricky Tomlinson was one of the greatest friends I had at the Echo. He just would do anything. And massive star of the Royal Family sitcom. You remember his great performances in there. And I asked him one day, I said, Ricky, I'd be fascinated to see the public reaction to you. It's one thing interviewing someone, putting it in the paper, people read it. But I want to walk with you from the centre of church, from centre of Liverpool, Church Street, outside Primark. I want to walk with you to the Echo offices, 10 minutes, 15 minutes away. And Ricky's saying, oh, waste of time, Paddy. No one's going to recognise me. No one's going to stop me. It'll be a waste of your time, waste of my time. It was absolutely hilarious. We got no more than 10 yards. We tried and tried and tried to start this walk. He was mobbed all the time.
Right.
And I remember him just standing in the middle of Church Street saying, this is why I live in Liverpool. People are amazed in London that I've not moved away. These people are not scared of showing their love and affection for you. And it was just a hilarious afternoon.
Talking about love and affection, how did you upset Joe Royal?
Joe, I thought you might ask me about this.
Well, you know.
This is, I know this is in the book. I do address it. It was a difficult chapter to write because I've been an Evertonian. My dad, as I say, Evertonian, born in Liverpool, brought me up an Evertonian. So when I was 6 years old, they won the title in 1970. Joe Royal, one of my heroes. And to think that many, many years later, I would upset him and having him call me not very nice names. Maybe it was my own fault. I think I was being a bit of a smart ass in a match report. I was, the morning paper, which has gone now, the Daily Post, was a bit less well-resourced than the Echo, and the sports writer there needed a bit of help now and again with match reports. So I did a few for the Daily Post under an assumed name.
In the nice seat at the foot, you could get a nice seat, free entrance, you know, well, all the pies and teas you can handle.
Well, this is it. It was lovely hospitality. It was great food, better than in the ordinary stand. You were being paid. You weren't paying to go. I thought, this is perfect. But in the end, you know, I sort of missed the experience of being back in my normal seat, swearing my head off, jumping up and down, because, you know, there's certain etiquette. You're not supposed to obviously celebrate a goal or swear in the press box. And so I think I did in the end, maybe 20-odd match reports. And only one, the very first one was Liverpool. And I couldn't, being an Evertonian and obviously so partisan, I found it very difficult to do a match report for Liverpool FC. So I did just Everton ones. And I mean, compared to now, Joe Royal's team was, you know, relatively not doing so bad. I think they were mid-table at the time, maybe. But knowing that this certain game back in 96, I think it was my last one, I think in the back of my mind, I was thinking I could have a bit of fun here. And the match reports for the Monday morning Daily Post were a bit different to the Echoes. They're a bit more reflective, and you weren't sort of explaining who passed the ball to who and whatever, because, you know, people knew what happened. They'd watched the highlights by then. And I remember that that half time, as every half time at the time, it seemed to be that the man in charge of the music played the Spice Girls, who were just starting out then, and their first single, what was it called, Wannabe? And I was like, oh my God. And I employed what journalists called a delayed drop intro, which this is where you write the intro, but it's not quite, that is not the story. You have to keep on reading it and go, ah, right. So I did. I was a bit mischievous. It was something like, how much longer? So Joe Royal's under a bit of pressure, to give you a bit of background for his job. There was actually a shout behind me as he appeared in the technical area that day for the first time, of someone shouting, resign! And it wasn't a member of the crowd. It was somebody in the press box. Right. I can't possibly say who it was. So that was a sort of atmosphere at the time. And so Everton actually won the game, but it was a dismal game. And my intro was something like, how much longer can we go on with days like these? Something like that. And I was talking about maybe it's time for heads to roll, or at least one head. So you're reading that as an Evertonian or any football fan, and you would imagine I'm writing about Joe Royal. Four or five paragraphs later, I'm calling for the head of the person who subjects us to the Spice Girls every bloody week.
Right.
Of course, Joe Royal saw it, went ballistic, rang the sports editor. Letters were exchanged. The letter is in the book that he wrote to the sports editor. And then fast forward a few weeks, obviously I've stopped doing match reports. I was at the Liverpool-Everton derby a few weeks later. We got a 1-1 draw, so I was very pleased about that. And as I was on my way to the pub to celebrate, a guy I work with was by the press room entrance, and Joe Royal was hovering around. My colleague said, come on, Joe, are you going to go in the press room or not? And he said, apparently, not if that spiky-haired, naughty word
person
before letters is in there. So that was me. And so I just thought, it is a bit sad because, you know, all those years ago, he was my hero and it's come to this, but maybe I'll meet him in a pub one day and we can laugh about it.
We can only hope. And just quickly, I mean, the Rooney family now, they're an interesting bunch. They're not averse to having a bit of an altercation in a car park during a family celebration. So how did you manage to get on their good books?
Fantastic. I was given what I thought was a pretty tough task. You've got to do a three-part series on the life of Wayne Rooney. So that would be six tabloid pages to fill. Problem one, Wayne Rooney is just 16 years old, so he's not actually had much of a life. Problem two, he's never played a game for Everton yet in the Premier League. Problem three, David Moyes, then manager, no, you can't speak to him. Problem four, we don't know where the family actually live exactly. We've got a rough idea. And so I was so fortuitous. We went out, and the day before I'd written a little, I think it was described by Bill Kenwright, the then owner of Everton, now the chairman. What did he describe it as? Sneering, arsey, I can't remember. It was a column about a new club song they were trying to put forward. But this phone call came through. I was told to ring him as I was in the car looking for Wayne Rooney's house. So spoke to Bill Kenwright, and Bill was like, I was explaining what we were trying to do, and Bill said, this is a fantastic story. It's such a good news story. So when we found the house eventually, I could tell Wayne Rooney's mum and dad without any word of a lie, because I'd just spoken to him. Bill Kenwright, I've just spoken to him, and he says, it's a great story. If I came and interviewed you, and you're, you know, I know I can't speak to Wayne about his life. So we got in, and the family were so good, the parents were so good, they showed us all these photographs of Wayne as a kid with Duncan Ferguson, who was obviously many years his senior, as a mascot at Liverpool FC. Lots and lots of family, well, obviously now very valuable pictures. So we copied all these photographs. They went around the world. And I heard all about Wayne's exploits as a 10-year-old goal scorer, an 8-year-old goal scorer, spoke to his parents, spoke to his teachers, and the scout who found him, put him forward for Everton, and we got the series done, but it was tricky at start.
I could talk to you probably for the rest of the day about this, but I'm going to...
Charles, too. I'm loving this. It's great.
We're going to crash it. Just quickly, I mean, I've got 3 minutes. In fact, I haven't got that long. But so let's just say, I'm going to say to people, go forth and buy the book. There's so much more. We didn't even touch on the music side and other bits and pieces. The book is called The Talk of Liverpool. It's by Paddy Sheenan. Paddy, if people want to find you online, do you have a social media presence? Where can they track you down as you did the Rooney family?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Paddy Shannon. The book is available direct from Mirror Books, www.mirrorbooks.co.uk. You can get it from Amazon, from Waterstones. Send me a tweet, unless you're Joe Royal, maybe.
Well, exactly. But perhaps we could bring you together in a kind of Hey Jude, na 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 at Glastonbury with Sir Paul kind of way. How's that, Paddy?
I have my doubts that would happen.
The book is called The Talk of Liverpool. It's by Paddy Shannon, and it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today, Paddy.
You too, Giles. Thank you.